listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. And I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and my mother, Caroline Kilbourne, was not able to be with us today, but she'll be back with us next week. And we have a really timely, interesting, fascinating book today to discuss. Our guest is Mitchell S. Jackson. Now, Mitchell's acclaimed debut novel, The Residue Years, won the Ernest Gaines Prize for Literary Excellence and was a finalist for a large number of awards, including the Penn Hemingway Award for First Fiction and the Hurston Wright Legacy Award. And Jackson has received numerous honors from such places as the Ford Foundation, Pen America, TED, New York Foundation for the Arts, etc. His writing has appeared in the New York Times Book Review, the Paris Review, the Guardian, Tin House, and elsewhere. He is a clinical associate professor of writing and liberal studies at New York University. The title of this book is Survival Math, Notes on an All-American Family. Welcome to Writers' Voices, Mitchell.
Thank you for inviting me.
Now, do you prefer to go by Mitchell or Mitch?
Whatever one feels most comfortable to you. If it were my students, I would say Mitchell, but
okay,
everyone else gets to pick.
Well, I can do Mitchell. I can do Mitchell. Okay. That's fine. So, Mitchell, you wrote a novel. I'm guessing, well, you published a novel. Have you written other novels other than the one that was published?
No, that was it. I stuck with that for a very long time. 13 years I worked on that novel.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, that's not the longest that I've had guests say they worked on a novel, so.
Oh, okay.
you're close to winning the prize, but not quite.
What is the prize? What's the longest?
You know, I think about 20 years. I think I had somebody who'd
Lord.
Worked on it about 20, yeah.
Yeah.
So, and now this book, Survival Math, is part memoir, part, what would you say, sociological study of inner city black communities.
Okay.
Partly history of Portland.
Yes.
And what else? What else is wrapped in here?
I guess the most simple way I would describe it is a memoir in essays. And I think I make the distinction in my head because I feel like each chapter has an idea at the heart of it that's like separate from whatever the preceding or the following chapter is. So I liked, but I also think that because all of them are kind of grounded in stories about me or my family, that's where the kind of memoir comes in. So I say a memoir in essays is the description I've been using, though it does include those other elements, you know, history, sociology, psychology a little bit.
Right, right. And what drove you to write this book?
So I was looking, when Residue came out, The Residue Years, which I just call Residue, the novel came out, it received a fair amount of critical attention, but I remember when I was sending it out on submission to agents, to editors, that one of the quotes, the responses that I got back from an editor that like drove me crazy was this. I felt that the combination of intellectual references and street slang and Champ's voice came off sounding oddly implausible, as original as it is. And it bugged me when I first read it. It bugged me like almost all the way through the process of publishing Residue. And I just kept thinking that, wow, this guy can't imagine that a guy could be both, you know, I guess for lack of a better explanation or description, like street smart and literary smart or academic. And I think that this book is a way for me to kind of force a reader to reckon with both of those selves.
Mm. It is, I think, unusual for a lot of people who aren't exposed to the type of community that you grew up in to understand that both of those are there.
Yeah.
And And so I think it's you're getting the word out.
I hope so.
Now, let's talk about the title,
Okay.
Survival Math, which is also the title of one of the essays.
Yes.
And it has to do with, if I get this right, you can correct me, sort of the calculations that a young, well, maybe not even just young, but the calculations that a black man in America today has to go through just to survive.
Yeah. I think I don't even know if I would limit it to black men. I think it's the calculations that people who are placed that often people who live in disadvantaged communities must compute in order to kind of either stay alive or to like have some sense of security in their life. And with me, it just so happened to kind of come out of a confrontation with a guy that could have ended up with me being dead. I wasn't actually thinking about it as survival math in those in the 20 years ago when it happened or 25 years ago, but I do know that there was several decisions that I had to make in a very short span of time. So he threatened me and said he would kill me, and between him saying that and me responding to him, I don't know how many kind of thoughts went through my head. But later on, when I started composing the book, and this is again decades later, I started to ask myself, well, I know that a lot of my family members are living in the same community, and I wondered if some of them had similar experiences, or if there were experiences that were different than mine, but that also had something to do with survival. And so I went and asked, I interviewed 16 men in my family, and I asked each of them the same question. And the question was, what's the toughest thing that you survived? And then I took their answers and I wrote them as second person narratives. Choosing the second person because I thought that it was one way to invite the reader to empathize and even to imagine themselves as the protagonist. And then I also wanted to give the people who I interview like a some form of anonymity, so I never distinguish which story belongs to which person either. So those are all. That's kind of part of their. They both the photos and the stories make up what's called the survival files in the book.
And those are interspersed between the essays.
Yes.
Right. And so the pictures, then these are all relatives of yours?
Yeah, relatives. All of my brothers, my uncles, cousins, grandfather is even in there.
And the photos. Kind of mostly look sort of like mug shots. Was that intentional?
Yeah, well, the one thing that I wanted to do was to decontextualize the images. So I should also say that a part of the photo, the reasoning for the photos was I was responding to. I started thinking about this when at the kind of inception of the Black Lives Matter movement, when they were saying that some of the people that were killed had looked dangerous or were threatening. And I
Right,
really
right.
wanted to see if I could kind of challenge that. And so what I did with the photos is I told them to take all of the jewelry off, earrings. I also placed them all in a, they were all wearing the very same thing, which is a black t-shirt. I framed them roughly the same. I shot them in black and white. So I was trying to remove as much context as I could from them to really invite the reader to question, did these men look dangerous? And then also to try to match the stories to the men. So, what is it that you see in a particular person that makes you think that they have done these things or had these kind of experiences, which to me is also kind of critiquing our implicit biases. And yeah, they do look like mug shots. There's a they used to have these rogue galleries in the, I think it was the 19th, like the mid 19th century, they were really famous, where they would take mug shots and like basically turn them into art. And so I think that this the cover very much represents like a kind of a neo rogue gallery. Though I also want to question this idea of what it means to be a rogue.
To be honest, when I first glanced at this, before I looked closely, I thought most of the men looked angry. But as I look closer, most of them look sad.
Well, I tried to get them to as much as they could not emote a particular emotion. I think that's hard for people who aren't trained actors, but I really wanted them to, not to reveal as little as they could, in the photo.
But your the eyes are always going to
Yeah.
they're always going to tell. You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Mitchell S. Jackson, author of Survival Math: Notes on an All-American Family. So you write about some difficult things in here.
Yes.
And what kind of feedback did you get from your family? Do they feel like you're revealing family secrets? You do try and provide anonymity to people who might want or need it, but still, there's a lot going on in here.
They haven't read it yet, most of them. So we haven't got to the what didn't they think part of it yet. And I'm actually leaving. I'm here in Wisconsin now, but my next stop on my tour is home. So I'm going home to Powell's, to Portland and Powell's bookstore, and everyone is asking for books. So I guess we shall find out what they think about what I wrote. But I think I go into it with not necessarily confidence, but with the I guess a little bit of the sucker of having, done the best that I could with the information and knowing that I was pretty pure-hearted in what, like I didn't write anything that I was intentionally trying to harm someone. And I also think that the people that I wrote the toughest things about are also the people that I have, like maybe the closest relationships with. So they understand our relationship outside of my writing, and I would hope that they understand that I have, I don't want to see them harmed. But then I also think, like the tough stuff is the stuff that you need to write about, because that's where the conflict is, and that's also where the challenge is to figure out how to write about it. And then, for me, it was like, well, why am I doing this? And I hope that there's, something to be gained for people who might be experiencing similar circumstances.
Well, the person that you were the hardest on was yourself.
Well, in one of them, yeah.
Well, throughout your, the secrets that you're revealing are probably, a good portion of them are your own. And so it's not like you're just hanging anybody else out there without you saying, I'm out here with you.
That was I had a mentor, Gordon Lish, an editor,
Oh
years ago.
yeah, I know who that is.
And one of the things he used to say is never elevate yourself above the other in your work. And I think that that is, I know that's a guiding light, and in both in my fiction and in my nonfiction, it's like if you can reveal something about or critique another person, then you also have to be able to turn that same level of critique on yourself in your work. And I think that that gives it a kind of fairness, in the work that I strive for.
And yeah, I can see that. I feel like you're successful at that. But as I was reading it, and the part that I think that you meant too, the where you're hardest on yourself is the essay titled "The Scale." And having had a little bit of experience on the other side of that story, What I'm wondering is, and what I, and I, now admittedly, I, you know, to do this, I do a show once a week, and so I have to read the books pretty quickly. So I may not have gotten everything out of it, but I kept wondering and didn't get an answer to why did you change? How did you change?
Well, I think there are multiple reasons for it. I think one of the kind of the simplest reason is like I got older, and my not only did I get older and my kind of values shift with the age, like I don't want to be out running around, and you know it takes a lot of energy, and it like you just can't keep that up. That's not an old man's
It's not
game.
sustainable. Maybe we should give a little context into what the scale is about here.
Okay, so the scale is essentially about levels of womanizing. And it really it uses a criminal profile, the structure of a criminal profile to interrogate the history of womanizers, but then to also situate myself in that history, and then to question, what was the environment that produced that, but also like what are the kind of psychological factors that did it, and then it also details the harms that I've caused women. And so it's really I was thinking this morning about it. I was like, well, I started that essay in 2011, and but I finished revising it, several months back, and that was really at the I don't know if it's the apex. Well, I guess we'll know years from now, but like what felt like the apex of the Me Too movement. And but then I said, well, it's different though because and you correct me if you think that I'm wrong, but like Me Too was about women forcing men to reckon with what they'd wrought against other women, right? But in this case, it was me too and myself.
It was. It was. And other men too. I mean, you were, you're saying, it's like, look at the
So,
harm that you're doing.
when you ask, how did I change? I think a part of it was growth, but it's also like I think the thing, and I don't know if I maybe got this through in the essay, is that this is part of a like community, and it's a community of like-minded thinkers for various reasons. And so, if you're a part of a community and the community's value systems change, then it gives you less reason or maybe even less opportunity to keep up the same behavior and have the same reinforcements. And so when my friends grow older and get married and have children and have really good jobs, and there's no there's not there's the reinforcement for what you're doing and is less. And so a part of it while you're doing it is that there's currency that you can use with other men. But when you lose that, it's like, well, then you have to ask yourself, like, why am I doing this? Like, is this just something that's inherent in me, or is this a part of my no nurturing or socialization? And I think for myself, I couldn't answer the question of why do it when there was like little positive feedback for it. So I think those are two kind of reasons for how I got to a space outside of that. I mean, I guess you could also say that I opened myself up more to vulnerability in my relationships, and maybe that's a part of being older. It could be a part of watching my daughter, who will be 18 this year, like I know that she's about to come into these relationships, and I definitely don't want to model something that I don't want her to interact with.
Now, you grew up in a neighborhood or in a community that where what would you say criminal what is considered criminal behavior is was pretty prevalent. It's particularly it seems like in the generation before you. And so has it gotten better? Is it continuing to improve? And I, you know, I'm making an assumption that less criminality is an improvement over more criminality, but
Well, I had this. Someone said in an interview, someone was talking about criminality before, and I was like, well, to a certain degree, the whether it's criminal or not is in the it's like the state,
Right,
right? So
right.
the so but one of the things in the scale that I talk about is the two types of crimes throughout history are what is it, mala in se, and then mala prohibita. So mala in se crimes are crimes that are wrong in and of themselves. So like they're like violations of our kind of moral code. And then mala prohibita crimes are like crimes that are wrong because the state statute and the state statute said because the state says so. And so when we talk about criminality, I mean, we could talk about crimes that are like wrong in and of themselves. And then, but then there are also, crimes that are like, well, they're just, they've been criminalized by
Right.
some kind of state. I think my kind of the men that I grew up with were on both sides of that. Like I would argue that, pimping is a mala in se crime. Like to take advantage of a woman, to force her, to coerce her, to go out and do your bidding, and to take all of her resources is mala in se. I think if we talk about drug dealing, I think we get into a kind of stickier place because, over the course of American history, certain drugs have been legal and not legal and back legal again. And
Right.
so then we have to ask ourselves, like, is it wrong in and of itself? I mean, if we looked at just, the marijuana, what's happening now all across the country, like, I know people who did time for marijuana and now that would not be the case. So is that mala in se or mala prohibita?
Well, I think that would be mala prohibita. Yeah.
So yeah, I grew up with men. I don't think that it's changed much, if at all, and that is because it's symptomatic of the social climate. And so, I mean, I don't think that black people are in any better shape than they were in the 1970s. I think we might have, we could say that we have exemplars, but I feel like the communities that were struggling are struggling in the same way that they were struggling 2, 3 decades ago, which produces what these men who are willing to engage in behavior that has been criminalized.
Now, looking at your family history, first of all, there seemed to be quite a lot of instability in the generation before you and maybe before that. But going back to your great grandparents was very stable. And what do you think, how did that get lost? How did that stability get lost?
How did I think the stability was lost in the fracturing of the family. So my great grandparents were married. Well, actually, my great grandmother, which I write about, died mysteriously. And then my great grandfather remarried a woman who I name is Mama Edie. That was her name. And so they stayed married, I don't know, 40 years. And they were the first Jacksons, my part of the family, that came to Portland. And she could not have children, so she adopted children, but they had a very stable household. But I guess this also gets back to mala in se and mala prohibita, because she was from a family of wealth, and the way that they gained their wealth was in the prohibition. So they were bootleggers. Her parents were bootleggers, and then they sent all their kids to college and bought a bunch of land in Alabama. So my grandmother was a person of means. My great grandmother was a person of means. So when they moved to Portland, they didn't really have to struggle in that sense. But my grandmother, my mother's mother, died in an altercation with my grandfather. And so that really was the first kind of fracturing of that family unit. And so from then on out, like none of my grandfather's children have had successful long-term relationships, except maybe, I don't even know if my uncle has. Yeah, so to me, that's where it kind of started on the Jackson side. Now on the Johnson side, my grandmother, my father's mother married several men and never stayed with them and had many different children. So there was also this kind of, we never, they never had a stability in their home. So I think it really starts with the kind of family unit.
Right. And societal influences, you know, a family unit isn't an island unto itself. So
Right.
there are certainly influences. And even, you know, a family of means, a family of that may appear from the outside as stable, like your great grands, there may have been stuff going on
Right,
behind
right.
closed doors that impacted the children from that family.
Yeah.
I mean, that's always, you never know. You never know. And so, Mitchell, why don't you read a little bit from Survival Math so we can get the listeners can kind of get a feel for your voice.
Okay. If there's a curse word, should I omit it or?
Yes, or
Okay.
yeah, that would
All
be
right.
useful.
I will do that.
Okay.
So I'll read what was the first survival file that I actually composed, which is actually the first survival file in the book, and I'll do my best not to curse.
Okay.
All right. You're out one night at the weekend hot spot off too many straight shots to count, and therefore the kind of faded you swear manifold you're funny when you hear a dude you don't know say blood to cap a sentence. I didn't know people were still gangbanging, you say, and search the mirrors' faces for mirth. But don't nobody smile nor laugh, and in fact, dude smacks you upside your dome as if your joke was his cue. In an instant, the two of you take to scrapping inside the club while neighborhood dudes whose account could damage your rep bear witness, and you best him before being wrenched apart and bounced outside. He paces one way, you pace the other. And in the distance between you lies the tacit truth that the animosity is in no way squashed. The next day, your friend is hosting your brother's moving to New York barbecue fish fry, and you show up hours prior, dump a shoebox carrying your Uzi and 9mm on the living room table, and shout to the group of gathered men and God, I heard somebody was looking for me. Well, let them know. I ain't hard to find. Somebody gonna die. In your mid-30s, you'll bust one shot near, but just near your father inside your crib, not to kill him, but to discourage him from discouraging you against prosecuting what might be your last ballistic beef. But on this day, you're in your late 20s, which in this case is plenty old enough to die. You stomp out of the house and slam yourself into your car, driven by your ride to beyond good sense girlfriend. Your brother calls and cautions you against doing something you'll regret, and furthermore against returning to the barbecue fish fry. Hours after his call, you flout your disinvitation, which is to say, you show up and stalk the yard with a waist-tucked 9mm bulging under your t-shirt and a scowl that ain't got no place near nothing festive. You see a dude who witnessed your scuffle the night before, a dude who's a friend of your new foe, and you flash your nine and threaten him into the basement. You lay your pistol in plain view and see. We can scrap right here, right now, you say. Nah, bro, I don't want no problems, he says, and warns your newest archest foe heard word of your whereabouts and is on his way to the barbecue fish fry for action. By now, almost everyone wants you to leave, including the father of the friend who's hosting, and it's the father's wish you decide to heed. Oh, the timing. You stomp out of the yard, peer down the street, and in the distance see your new arch foe among a circle of dudes. You pull the pistol from your waist, and men, women, and God's only begotten son, be darned, march into the middle of the street. Once, you told a grade school teacher of your plan to become a hitman, and though you haven't considered that career choice in ages, Today could be the day that delivers you to the threshold of that young hope. Before you shoot yourself into that fate, a girl you know from high school darts between you and your new foe. She calls your name, pleads, please don't, please. She announces your fast foe is her brother, appeals once more against gunplay, and you pause, seeing an escape out of what a breath before felt foreordained. Oh, that's your brother, you say? And lower your pistol. The next week, you pull into the parking lot of the grocery store with your daughter in the passenger seat, and out of some place unseen, your foe pulls up beside you. Neither hand touches the wheel, and you bet blood on why they aren't in view and what one holds. Decisions, of which the most fool would be to reach for what's under your seat. Your daughter is a fifth grader, which is to say, in this instance, plenty old enough to die. You curl over her, embrace, and when you don't hear a pistol bark, you raise your head, shake it. No, 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 no. No, 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 no. Look your faux eye to assassin black eye and mouth. Man, I don't want no problems. It's squash. It's squash. He idles for what could be the rest of your and your firstborn's life.
And that was Mitchell S. Jackson reading from Survival Math, Notes on an All-American Family. So I'm curious about the survivor files, which there's 16, right, of them in here, and they're all about that length. How long, you know, did you spend like hours in conversation with these men to and to boil it down their story into, you know, such a succinct, powerful story?
Yeah, that's I did them all. You know, I don't know if you heard of Ten House Magazine. Have you heard of this?
Yeah, in fact, Michelle Wildgren used to be their editor, and I took a course from her once, and she's been on the show before. Yeah, I don't know if she's still there or not, but anyway.
Well, you know, they're closing. Well, not the magazine. Is it the magazine? Yeah, the magazine is closing.
Oh, wow, that's too bad.
Yeah, but they have the Tin House, which is a place in downtown Portland, and what I didn't know is that they let writers stay in the Tin House for very cheap. And so one summer I came home and I stayed there for like 12 days. And I actually conducted most of the interviews for the survival files in Tin House. Mm. And so I would just call, you know, my uncles, cousins, and I would just invite them over. I had a setup. I shot all of these as Polaroids, and then I would, you know, sit down and talk to them for an hour or two. And then I would always have follow-up. So one thing that the survival files do, and it actually started from that file, I guess that was the template for them, is that there's always a moment in the file where I look into the past and one moment where I look into the future. So in this particular one, I look into the future where he'll shoot at his father in his house, and then I look into the past where he said once that he wanted to be a hitman. So I was also trying to find moments that I thought contextualized the current, whatever the current moment was.
Right. Yes. Yeah, see, now if you hadn't pointed that out, I wouldn't have noticed it.
Yeah.
But that's it's really interesting to carry that thread through all of these.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's Gordon. He said, what you do once, you must do twice.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Wow. So what led you to become a writer? You must get that question a lot.
Yeah. Well, I try to refine it so I can I don't necessarily know if I know, but, so I used to journal a lot, especially when my mom was first struggling with her addiction and I didn't have an outlet to talk about it. I wrote in journals, and I only know this cause I don't remember doing it because she kept some of those notebooks. And so all of this was really me talking about trauma. But I didn't consider myself a writer. I was not a childhood reader. I didn't start like reading, really reading until I was already in graduate school for writing, but the first novel that I remember reading was when I was in prison. And then we had like a two shelf bookshelf, or yeah, two shelf bookshelf. And I read a few novels while I was incarcerated, and that's where I thought, like, oh, I'm gonna write my life story. One, because people like to make that claim in the while they're locked up, that if someone wrote their life story, it would be a bestseller. But then also because I was on an academic scholarship when I went to prison, and I knew I was going right back to college, and so I wanted to start preparing my faculties for going back and being, forced to think in a different way. And so I thought writing would prepare me for school. I got out in July of 1998, and in September of 1998, I was enrolled back in college. So it was a really quick turnaround.
And when you were in prison, was it for something that today you wouldn't have been locked up for?
No, I would have been locked up for it. It
Oh,
was for
okay.
selling crack. So it
Ah,
was
okay.
crack and a gun. So yeah, I
Yeah.
don't think they're going to decriminalize that anytime
But you were in college.
Yeah, I was in college.
It's
I was
like.
studying speech communications, but I didn't really have a focus. I thought I was going to play basketball, and I thought that eventually I would go overseas and play. And so school was just something to do that kind of made me not feel like a failure while I was selling drugs. But also, it gave me like a reason to get up and to have something to do and to feel like it was purposeful.
Do you feel like you were lucky to have broken that cycle of dealing drugs and pimping and so forth and go to college, or was it something other than luck?
Well, the crazy thing is, most of the men that I write about, maybe even all of them, at least, and I'm talking about like my forebears, so like my uncles, my dad, all of them went to college at some point.
Really?
Yeah, they were all really bright. Yeah, some of them became preachers. They all like real first rate rhetoricians. So like in that sense, I mean, I don't think any of them, maybe a couple of them graduated, so, but I don't think most of them graduated, but they all went. So they all, in their own way, saw the value of like formal education.
So you were following tradition, not breaking with
Yeah.
it.
But maybe I was the first one to like go in and graduate. And I was also like, I mean, I was like on the honor roll and the dean's list and all that. So maybe, I don't know if they did that, but yeah, they all went and I would say they were all really smart. I mean, they definitely were witty and, resourceful and all of those things. But also, I think, book smart.
I found it interesting and I don't remember which essay it is in. Oh, I think it's the one about the pose, which is about pimping.
Yes.
The sort of pimp to preacher path.
Yeah. Yeah. But if you think it like makes complete sense
Oh,
because
yeah.
they're doing the same thing, and actually like corrupt preachers are really just pimps,
Yeah.
right? Like they take all of the offering, they go buy their Cadillacs and Rolls Royces and jets and all of that stuff, and they really are head down and palm up, literally.
Yeah. Which is what the pose, head down, palm up. What
Yeah.
does that mean?
So it's a position that I mean you're supposed to it's as a pimp when you are dealing with a woman that's working for you're supposed to keep your head down and put your hand out so it's what can she give you and then also you're never looking at her so I think it's in one way it's like to kind of ignore the harm that you're causing. And the other way is like your hand is always out because that is one, you need it, but that's also you have to enforce upon her that this is the only thing that she should be doing for you, is like giving you all of her resources. And so I take that idea and then try to extrapolate and say, well, what other areas of American culture are other people using this same kind of ideology?
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Mitchell S. Jackson, author of Survival Math, Notes on an All-American Family. One thing that surprised me in that, I believe it was in that chapter where you're talking about your aunt who became a sex worker by her own insistence.
Yeah.
Is that a common thing? Do you think that, because, you know, there's the whole idea of trafficking and how wrong that is, but then if a woman chooses that work,
right.
Is that wrong?
Then,
is that, you know, what's, it's confusing.
You know, I didn't even, until I started doing the research, like, I didn't know that she was so insistent upon that. And I don't, I mean, I mean, it does make it really hard to find the pure fault in that kind of relationship. At least the way, I mean, but again, you know, she's passed, so I'm only getting his side of the story. But
right.
I remember I just read recently, recently meaning I guess the last few months, there was someone who posted something on Facebook, a guy that I know who's like, I don't know if he's a former pimp or he's a current pimp, but he at some point was involved in life. And then the woman, it was a woman that posted, and the way that she spoke, I mean, it was clear that she had been a sex worker, but she spoke about it as if, like, in the same way that my aunt did, was like, you know, I don't know why people are disparaging this, and like, this is what I do, and I have this set of rules. And I was like, wow, like, that was so interesting to me. It wasn't like she was portraying herself as a victim. She was actually like proud of it almost. And so I guess that has to be like the most kind of rare circumstance. So I would think most women, but even then, it's like, what are the forces that made her believe that that was an option in her life? What kind of moral milieu is she in that like she can make that okay in her world? So even if she's saying like this is what I want to do and you know I'm gonna do it anyway, like I think we would have to take a longer look at that and say like, well, what are the forces that make this an option in a person's life?
Well,
so,
it's, I think, to some extent, other opportunities being very limited.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So then I guess the other point is like, well, then it's not really an option for anyone.
Right. Right. If that's your only option, then it's not an option.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. So, some of the other things that I found really fascinating, you're writing in one chapter about how the gang started, and I guess that's survival math. It's in that chapter. And there was a sentence in here, you're kind of comparing the gangs to nations and to nationalism. And of course, that's one of the reasons why this book is so timely, because of the rise in nationalism, both here in the U.S. and in Europe. And you write this one sentence that really just struck me. It says, members of a nation, I'll call them nationalists, love in proportion to the sacrifices that they've committed and the troubles suffered. And the reason that jumped out at me is because, you know, I'm not afraid to say that I think Trump is an abomination and what's happening in our country is horrible. And I don't, and it's so hard to understand these people who are so harmed by his policies and yet support him. And this is an explanation for that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just like shared suffering coheres a nation more than their shared triumphs. But that wasn't, I mean, I think I'm paraphrasing there, but I do agree with that. Right. So the more that he can paint them as being victimized by some aspect of American culture, the more it's unifying them, and the more that we kind of, you know, can't understand them and count us and other them, right, as a thinker outside of what, you know, the mainstream, the more that they unify. So it's like fighting a monster that you can't win, because the more that you're like, or more, the more you call them a monster, the stronger the monster becomes.
Yeah. And you keep thinking, well, they've got to wake up and see that they're being victimized by the same forces that they're following. How, you know, when are they going to see that? And that the people that they demonize are the ones that are trying to help them. It's
But you know, there's in the essay, oh man, which one is it? It might be, I think it might be man, I don't remember actually which essay it is, but there is every, it might be in Survival Man, but it's like every country has a, every nation has a sacrifice, right? And so, and so these kind of marginalized groups become the sacrifice for the nation to prosper. And I think there's also something to be said about, and maybe that, I think that's in American Blood, actually. But I think that that is, like, if you can convince someone that, like, you love the state so much that your lack of prosperity is actually a sacrifice that the nation, that the nation demands, then you can make it like something for them to be proud of as well.
Right. And it does sometimes seem like people who get less out of the system that we have are the most patriotic.
Right. Yeah.
Which, you know, is puzzling, but is also understandable because of what you just said.
Yeah.
All right, we're getting short on time, so I have a couple other things I want to get to.
Okay.
Another way this book is really timely is the current attention being paid to the idea of reparations. And you do get into a little bit, there's not a lot of it, but a little bit into what happened, you know, how when the slaves were freed
Oh,
and
yeah.
how what a deep hole they were starting the freed slaves or former slaves or what is it? People who had been enslaved, rather than
Yeah.
identifying them as, rather than slavery being part of their identity, being something that
Right.
happened to them. What a deep, deep hole they were starting out in, and how that still has an impact today.
Yeah. Yeah, that's in that essay I was trying to figure out. I was really kind of thinking about my father, my stepfather, my uncles, and like who were lifetime hustlers. And then like, well, where did this come from that they felt like this was a necessity for them? And so I was trying to track the genesis of the hustler as I knew it, and it just at some point it just dawned on me that like there would have been no need for hustling when they were enslaved, and that so that meant that hustling as I knew it had to have been born after manumission. And so it was really me kind of tracking, you know, what did manumitting the slaves do? And you know, there's a famous Frederick Douglass speech where he's saying like, well, yeah, they freed them, but they freed them to famine and to suffer and to, you know, all of those things. Like all you really got was like a certain ostensible freedom, while everything else was you were still enslaved. And so one of the things I think in the book that maybe kind of breaks it out as conventional memoir as well is that I imagine whole scenes. So like I imagine one slave coming out of or an enslaved person being manumitted, right? So I didn't have, I could not find the first person to start hustling, so I had to invent that. I do the same thing with like imagining Frederick Douglass making a reprisal of his What to the Slave is the 4th of July speech. So there are moments where they're like pure fiction in this book. They're few and far between, but and I also make sure that I hope prep the reader that what follows is pure imagination. But you know, I couldn't get to some of those things, and I had to figure out, well, how am I going to do this?
Right. Is there a type of writing that you enjoy doing most?
No, I just enjoy sentence making.
Mm.
So as long as I can make sentences, to make sentences, so I like the freedom to make the kind of sentences I want to make. So like, I will refuse an opportunity if I feel like the publication will won't accept my voice. Because I think that to me the voice is who I am, and so it's the identity. And if you take that away from me, it's like you've taken away my power. So I do like that, though I had trouble with the Cento poems, right? Because I had to use the language that was already in the documents. So that's a different thing. But I still tried to like organize the sentences in a way that still was representative of how I think about the world.
And are you working on another project now?
I wish that I was working on another project right now. But I do, actually, I have kind of started, like, I've taken notes and watched a couple documentaries, and I know what it is. I'm writing a novel based on a cult in Portland that was led by a black man.
Oh, wow.
So I'm really excited because I get to create a voice, like a voice that's, biblical. But then also he was like from Watts, California, so he's also like streetwise. So I'm really excited to kind of figure out what that sounds like.
And I kind of switch subjects, but what are your thoughts about reparations, since that's now a really timely subject?
If they were giving them out, I would be in line to get them. I just can't. I think here's what I think. I think that if we give out reparations and then we keep the same systems in place to keep people of color, or I guess in this case black people, like excluded from the means of like keeping the wealth, then
Exactly,
it's
yeah.
like winning the lottery.
Exactly.
So like as long as the financial markets are set up as they are, us having a bunch of money wouldn't necessarily, like it would be great in the short term, but like it's not going to create generational wealth because there's a book, I didn't read the book, but I saw it on a book review, and the guy's basic premise was that the financial, what did he call, what did he say? Yeah, but the financial system or the financial markets and philanthropy were arms of white supremacy. And like they're basically saying that they both maintain the status quo. And so I really do think that like you could give us a bunch of money, but if we didn't have access to like the best schools and if we couldn't participate in the markets in the way that they do, then
Or
a
even
generation
to
that.
have the, if you don't grow up in an environment that knows how to deal with money, it can be very hard to learn that successfully
Yes.
later. I've seen this with some very, very close friends.
Yeah, I think I'm learning it now.
Yeah, it can be very, very challenging. And so it's very likely that a large portion of people would not be able to hang on to the money for very long. And
Yeah.
that's common, whenever there's a redistribution of wealth for whatever reason, it ends up getting concentrated again.
Yeah.
That's his, look at history, you're going to find that. My fear is that if the US government did these reparations, then that would be like an excuse for, okay, the playing field's even now, so
Yeah.
we're not going to do
Well,
anything else.
it's
And
kind of like the post-Obama backlash, right? Like, y'all had a
yeah.
black president, everything was good. Like, now we can just take
Yeah,
everything away.
exactly. I know. So we're out of time, and it's been so much fun talking to you today, Mitchell.
Yeah. It's
Yeah.
been
And
a
good luck with your tour. I know you're just starting out and you've got a
Yeah.
ways to go. And I want to recommend to all my listeners Survival Math: Notes on an All-American Family. Mitchell quotes a very powerful speech by Frederick Douglass on manumission in the book. And since Caroline isn't here to provide our closing quote, here is a quote from Frederick Douglass that I think is very appropriate for this book. It is easier to build strong children than to repair broken men. See you all next week on Writers' Voices.